Hello and welcome to Darling Why. I'm Kate, and this week Louis and I are going through the sci-fi classic Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. If you like our show, please give us a like and a follow, and with that, let's get into it. So Louis, we often start with a question.
Yeah.
And therefore, I must ask, do androids dream of electric sheep?
I don't know. You tell me.
Unfortunately, the book doesn't really answer this question.
What?
But yeah, I know. I've been scammed. But yeah, today we're talking about Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. So
you could say this is a conversation all about Dick.
You could.
I mean, you could say that. That doesn't mean you
should. I won't, because I'm...
Nor will I. But I'd like to
venture
the possibility.
I'm a classy lady. I'm not going to...
Citation needed.
Wow. Before I get into the book, I just wanted to give a little background on Philip K. Dick. Philip Kindred Dick. Great name. Great name. The K stands for Kindred.
Hello to you, my Kindred Dick. That's all I heard. It sounds like a character from fucking Elder Scrolls. You must speak to Kindred Dick, or he will give you the final quest.
So Philip Kindred Dick was a prolific American sci-fi writer. He wrote 44 novels and 121 short stories in his lifetime, which is a lot.
It is a lot.
That's very... I don't think he stopped writing ever, maybe.
I think the only person who could even, like, say he was a slouch is Stephen King.
Maybe,
then again,
yeah.
Cocaine.
Certainly substances involved in this story too. Even if you think you don't know Philip K. Dick, you probably do.
Yeah.
His work has been adapted particularly to the screen quite
yes.
a lot. So if you've seen Blade Runner, Minority Report, Total Recall, Adjustment Bureau, A Scanner Darkly, Man in the High Castle, Channel 4's Electric Dreams, or a number of others, you have consumed the work of PKD.
Mm-hmm.
So he has also gone on to be a major influence on many other works. So mainly he's almost like proto-cyberpunk.
Yes.
While The Matrix isn't based on anything that he wrote, his work is certainly an
yeah.
influence on the whole vibe.
I would agree.
And many others. Just The Matrix is probably the most famous of that type of thing, unless you are deep in a
yeah.
sci-fi cyberpunk kind of world. Philip K. Dick wrote sci-fi that involved aliens and androids in space, but... what makes him interesting, to me anyway, and I would argue probably to a lot of people, is he uses this to explore themes that are relevant and kind of prescient to our current lives
yeah.
in this day and age. Writing for Wired, Eric Davis outlined five main themes that make up Dick's philosophy and work, which are false realities, human versus machine, entropy, the nature of God, and social control, which are all... I think all of those things are at the very least touched upon in this book, and certainly across the spectrum of his work. He was a visionary and a complex man, and an endlessly interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
He's prolific in his work, and he's been lauded as one of the great sci-fi writers ever to live, but he did face persistent challenges with substance use and mental ill health. And I would not be doing him justice to give a 30-second rundown of his life and his philosophies, his experiences and what inspired some of his work, but it trust me when I say that it is endlessly fascinating to read about. But if I wanted to do it justice, it would take me many hours and a lot of preparation that I am...
That's the Patreon.
Exactly. If and when we make a Patreon, maybe I will just do a deep dive on the life of Philip K. Dick.
Deep dive on Dick. Triple D.
That's not what Guy Fieri would have wanted that to stand for, Louis.
He may not have wanted it, but it does now.
Oh.
Sorry, Guy.
But yeah, there is certainly a lot to dig your teeth into if you are interested in him, like, as a person and his life and the way he worked.
Yeah.
So just to touch on that before I move on to the book
yes.
itself. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is a book that I read this year,
mm-hmm.
and it is the first full-length novel from Philip K. Dick that I have read.
Mm-hmm.
I have read some of his short stories, like Beyond Lies the Wub and The Hanging Stranger, and I've consumed a lot of the movies and screen stuff
yeah.
that he's produced, and it's always, again, endlessly interesting to me. But this is the first actual, you know, original source,
yeah.
full-length content I've put in my brain. I wonder, I'm just curious if you, because we've watched a lot of the movies based on his work
yeah.
together, so I knew you have obviously consumed some of his stuff. I wonder, have you read some of his stuff, or is this kind of relatively new pasture for
this
you
is
as well?
This is new pasture for
okay.
me. When I was much younger, I was trying to track some of this down when I used to spend a lot of time in the library.
Mm.
because I wasn't really doing much with my life at the time. And I was trying to track down a few books of this sort of thing. There were a few I tried down, but no Philip K. Dick, but I managed to get a lot of other stuff.
Yeah.
Like, that was the era that I read things like Dune and stuff like that. But no, they never seem to have any Dick.
Yeah, no, there's something about, like, the last 3 months of this year, I really wanted to go kind of in on some of the more kind of, I suppose, the classics of sci-fi.
Yeah.
So I started by reading a bunch of H.G. Wells, mm-hmm. which is proper classics of sci-fi because it's from the Victorian era.
Yeah.
But then I kind of went in on some 60s and 70s era stuff.
Yeah.
Which I suppose is kind of what I think about when I think about sci-fi. I've been a big fan of sci-fi for a very long time, for most of my life. But yeah, this is the first time I've kind of gone into, like, what I would say kind of the greats of it. You know, Arthur C. Clarke and Philip K. Dick. And I do want to, this year, go properly into Frank Herbert as well. And not just have this weird knowledge of Dune having never read the books, which I do. I have, like, quite an in-depth knowledge of what happens in Dune, but I've not read any of the books. It's very strange. Anyway, sci-fi tangent aside, so background to the book, The Android's Dream of Electric Sheep was released in 1968, and it was nominated for a Nebula Award that same year. I wanted to originally try and, like, place this within his work, like, oh, this is his third book, but he released so much novels and stories. Like, if you look at his bibliography, it's over 1968 alone. This was not his only work published. He had already kind of broken through. He had won a Hugo Award already at this point and had been nominated for some other Nebula Awards. So just, you know, it's not this is the breakout.
Yeah.
But it is obviously one of the most well-known of his works.
Yeah.
People have heard of Blade Runner. I had heard of Blade Runner a lot longer than I had heard of this. And obviously then Blade Runner 2049 came out a couple of years back, and that kind of brought it back up again. So this is really well known. And just to give an overview of the book, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but just an overview. Set in either 1992 or 2021, depending on the edition you get, because it got moved at some point.
Mm.
So Android's Dream of Electric Sheep follows Rick Deckard. He's a bounty hunter who retires rogue androids coming to Earth from the human colony on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
So in this iteration of Earth, nuclear war has left both humans and animals decimated, and many have fled to off-world colonies. You're often hearing about the Mars colony, which is the closest one, I would think, but there's others as well. And those who are left are often either there for work, like Rick, they have to have bounty hunters on Earth, or they're not considered good or worthy or whatever enough to be allowed to immigrate off-world. So your character who embodies that in the book is John Isidore, whose IQ is too low and he's been too affected by the radiation left from nuclear war to be considered, like, worthy to go. Acceptable, yeah, exactly. So he's stuck on Earth.
Yeah.
And as well as following the main plot of Rick Deckard hunting down Nexus 6 androids, they have injured his colleague and he's been given the task to take them down. We get to explore the lives of those still living on Earth. For example, his wife gets mentioned a lot, even though she is pretty much a side character, and John Isidore is there too. You see the religion of mercerism that has kind of taken over, the sanctity of animals in the world and having a pet as a status symbol, and essentially navigating the existential question of what is the world that we have been left with. So on the surface, you do have quite a cool, very well-paced tale of chasing down escaped robots, which is cool, you know, it's pretty rad. But it does kind of coats this existential question. Oh, you just want to kind of gnaw into it, you know. I wanted to talk about three main things that jumped out to me reading this book, but before I get, I just want to say it's a really, I listened to this on audiobook,
first
of all, so I didn't read it. I listened to it, as I do with most
audiobooks.
Books
are very valid.
I consume many books in a year, and I would say maybe three of them I read with my eyes, because I like to be able to do other, I can listen to audiobooks while I do other things, so a lot of what I consume is with audiobook, and certainly in audiobook form this is such a perfectly paced, a really well paced book. You know, it clips along at a lovely pace, you know.
Okay.
It never seems to drag.
Yeah.
And there is this, I'll touch on this again later. There are moments that are kind of a bit surreal and you're like, oh, we're obviously, like, in mostly Rick Deckard's point of view.
Yeah.
Is he a reliable narrator? What's going on? Where am I? You know, there's that kind of confusion, like intentional confusion. And there is something about listening to an audiobook that really enhances that, because if I was reading a book, I would just flick a few pages back and like check, am I understanding? I'm not rewinding the audiobook. It's not happening. I'm just powering through that shit. So it does add to that sort of like, slightly what's going on, which is the intent. It's not just like poorly plotted or whatever.
Yeah.
I just think it's a very accessible and consumable sci-fi book, which not all sci-fi books are.
Yeah.
It's a nice, healthy little clip of a book.
Yeah.
So that was just one thing I wanted to like really hit off. And also when I finished it, it's all I wanted to talk about. That's when I made the decision to do this for the podcast, which is like a month, maybe 6 weeks ago, I decided I wanted to do it. And I just was like, I need someone else to immediately read this book and just answer my stupid questions. Like ones that aren't necessarily like these key points I want to talk about.
Yeah.
But like, for example, there is one point, there is a, and this is a spoiler, I suppose, so whatever. If you haven't read the book or seen the movie, I'm sorry. But there is a girl in it called Rachel who turns out to be an android, and she's self-aware. She knows all this. And there is this kind of question of like, well, can you fall in love with an android, or are you essentially just using them as sex bots?
Yeah.
And there is this interaction with them where it really seems like Rick Deckard is like falling in love with her, and she is using him like to save her android friends or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm like, mate, you, how easy did she trick you?
Yeah.
Like, you went from like, I must kill all androids to I'll run away with you in like 4 seconds. What, who is this guy? Like, I really just wanted to talk about that with someone for like an hour, you know, because it was shocking. Yeah. I don't know if that happens in the movie. I have no idea. But in the book, listening to it, I was like, mate, she's clearly using you. What?
Yeah.
You yourself. Anyway, it's one of those books I really did just like want to immediately talk, like it was bubbling up inside of me. Yeah. I just needed to talk about it. And not all books leave me with that, you know? I'd say there's a handful of books I've read this year that I was like, I need to immediately talk about. And it's always a book that I know no one else who's read it or read it recently.
It's you kind
know
of how what I mean? Feel about Disco Elysium.
See, now I have completed Disco Elysium. Since we recorded the pod, I've completed it, and we can't talk about it now without you spoiling it for me. But yeah, I agree. Disco Elysium is something I want to talk about. And even when I was playing it, I was like, oh, I'm at this bit. You should do this. And so I feel similarly about this book. So, I mean, that's kind of my overall review, I suppose.
Yeah.
It's certainly, like I say, there's a lot of, like, I read a Space Odyssey, 2001 Space Odyssey this year as well. Yeah. And it's really well written. But it's
thick.
It's not even that. It's just, it feels much more like science-y. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot more like hard science in it.
Do you not respond as well to those sorts of...
I do, but I suppose it's not on the same emotional level. I thought it was a really interesting book. I thought it was a really well-written book, and I did enjoy it.
It's the sort of thing that makes you go, yes. Rather than, oh, wow.
It's just, but it's also just two different feelings. It's a two different feelings.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's that question of like, there is a kind of, some people will divide it into like hard science fiction and soft science fiction.
Yes.
And with soft science fiction focusing more on like that psychology and existentialism. Yeah. And obviously, given my background and interests, the soft science fiction is going to appeal to me more.
Yeah.
Although I still, like I say, I do find the hard science fiction interesting still. Yeah. I still want to read it, but it doesn't provoke the same, oh my God, I gotta talk about this immediately kind of feeling once I finish it, you know? I'll actually get into some proper points now instead of just word vomiting.
All points are proper.
Oh, I'm just word vomiting my praise now. I'm just like, it's so good, guys. You should read it. But I'll actually say some stuff about the book now. I really enjoyed what this book says about what it means to be human, which I think is something that Philip K. Dick touches on quite a lot. Like, what does it actually mean to be a human person? And like, that is a central conflict of the book, is that it's hard to differentiate between humans and androids. And to do so, you have to administer a test. Like, you cannot eyeball it. And even now, even that is not always easy to do, because like at the start of the book, they bring out like this new model of android, these Nexus 6 types. And one of the ways they're going to differentiate it is how do androids react to certain scenarios? Like, do they have empathy?
Yeah.
Is essentially what they are testing. Like, that's a really interesting question. As someone who's had to think about, like, what is empathy and how do we express empathy?
Yeah.
And even if we're feeling empathy, how do we communicate that? It's something I've had to think about quite a lot
okay.
in my line of work. Like, that's yeah. just part of what it
part
is.
Of the game.
So I really responded to this question of, like, well, what is empathy and who can experience empathy? And is that what makes us human? Because I don't think the book is saying, like, empathy is the only thing that makes us human, but it is, like, a big differentiator between the two.
Yeah.
Is this kind of ability to empathically connect with people. Androids are framed as, like, very intellectual, but not yeah. able to really understand that.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is, like, you get this juxtaposition of this sort of, like, androids are only intellectual and can't feel empathy with the actions of the other people in the book.
Yes.
And, like, even Rick Deckard at the start of it
yeah.
and the way he responds to his wife at the start and the end is quite different. And there are points where he's, like, you know, out with his colleague, his partner, who's also a bounty hunter. And he's
yeah.
just like, fuck him. He's like,
yeah.
I'll kill the shit out of these robots.
Yeah.
I don't care. You know, and
yeah.
he's kind of like, oh, I don't know. They feel very, like, they care about each, you know, Rick Deckard's having this, like, existential crisis
yeah.
about his job. And his colleague's like, nah, mate, they're gone. And if any of us were robots, I'd kill you as quickly, or you should kill me as quickly. Like, they're quite unable to empathize
yeah.
with the thing, even though it's so, on the surface, identical to human.
Yeah.
And that is something that Rick Deckard struggles with over the course of the book. Like, that really
yeah.
is a key question. And it's enhanced by those moments of surreality I was talking about
yeah.
and, like, what's going on.
Yes.
And, like I say, I think that popped more because I was listening to it on an audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just this really engaging question that I find. And, like, again, to kind of follow on from that, I really do like how the book explores empathy and connection specifically, and I suppose isolation as an opposite to
right.
connection.
Uh-huh.
So, like, writing for Nature, Ananya Bhattacharya writes, "Androids explores this blurred human-machine boundary through Deckard's existential anxiety and through the Penfield mood organ.
Yeah.
This device allows humans to dial up urges or emotions, such as the desire to watch TV, no matter what's on,
uh-huh.
by inputting a number." Named after Wilder Penfield, the real-life 20th century neurosurgeon who showed that brain stimulation could elicit sensations and visions,
yeah.
the organ reifies Dick's fears that humans could become more robotic, end quote. So there is this machine, and you kind of open on it, where, like, you if you weren't feeling something, if you weren't feeling
yeah.
happy, if you weren't feeling productive, you can just dial in a number and you will then feel it.
And, okay.
and we, in the opening of the book, Rick Deckard's wife, Erin, just doesn't want to do it.
Yeah.
She's like, I would like to just dial in a depression for myself because
yeah.
I just can't
yeah.
deal with this anymore. This nothing response, you know,
yeah.
it's not a kind of a natural happiness, nor is it a natural sadness.
Yeah.
It's just kind of neutral. And
yeah.
is it really a feeling?
Yeah.
If you're dialing it in.
Mm.
It reminds me, it's not the same because it is framed differently, but it does remind me of a little bit of, like, Sense Offenders in
yes.
Equilibrium.
Yeah.
That is looking at it a slightly different way because it's not just emotion.
Yeah.
But it is a similar sort of bluntedness.
That film was 100% influenced by Dick.
Sure.
Sorry for the slight tangent, everyone, but that is a very, very, it's a very strange martial arts movie, but not martial arts movie, but...
Worth
yeah.
a watch. And again, it raises interesting questions to
yeah.
me about experience.
Yes.
Like, the act of experiencing
yeah.
and what that contributes to kind of the being human of it all.
Yeah.
And, like, I suppose in this world of androids, the mood organ is one machine that they have. The other machine they have is an empathy box.
Yeah.
And what you do is it essentially links you in to the rest of the world, like the other humans in the world.
Yeah.
It kind of touches on the idea of the collective unconscious, which is Philip K. Dick touched a lot on, like, these Jungian principles.
Yeah.
So a very simplistic description of what Jung meant by the collective unconscious is the unconscious mind and shared mental concepts of all humanity. So
the way
I think the easiest kind of cultural touchstone is things like archetypes and the monomyth, the hero's journey, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, why do they keep popping up amongst different cultures who would have never talked to each other? And Jung sort of theorized that this was because of the collective unconscious.
Yeah.
And Philip K. Dick touched on that quite a lot. So a quote from the book about what is an empathy box is from the character of John Isidore. He says, "But an empathy box," he said, stammering in his excitement, "is the most personal possession you have. It's an extension of your body. It's the way you touch other humans. It's the way you stop being alone."
Yeah.
And like, that to me is the other, like, really, not to get too pandemic of it all, but particularly in the last 2 years,
that
there's
point.
Something about,
I just didn't know if you want me to make,
there's
it.
Something about reading this book in these pandemic times. Like, there is something about having a box that connects you to other, a machine that connects you to other people. I say, tapping my laptop. And I suppose in their way, like, they touch the empathy box, and you can share your feelings with other people, and they can experience them, and vice versa. And like, people are obsessed with their empathy boxes. Like, they're really, really connected to them, I suppose.
Can I just ask, do you know when Philip K. Dick passed away?
In the 80s.
So he didn't basically live to see his empathy box made real about 35, 40 years later, because...
Oh, smartphones? Yeah.
Social media is basically the empathy box.
Similar. Yeah, there's a lot of writings online that talk about the fact that, like, the things that we have now to create connection at a distance, I suppose.
Yeah.
This is a prototype of that.
Yeah.
It's a predictor of that.
Yeah.
And this kind of, there is this need and compulsion for connection amidst the isolation, because Earth is... like, there's still people on Earth, but it's largely abandoned, you know? John Isidore lives alone until the androids move into his building. Like, he's in a full, like, tower block alone.
Yeah.
And then, like, the androids are hiding out there.
Yeah.
And he reflects to himself that, like, okay, I was fine when I was on my own, because essentially I didn't know any better.
Yeah.
And now that they're here, I can't go back to having no one in the building. Like, you know, there's that whole thing, which I think is... I don't know, not to get too deep into panic those thoughts, but like, you kind of, we were in lockdown so long last year, you kind of get used to it a little bit, but then seeing people again and having to go back into lockdown, like, that's harder, I think. To
what year are you referring to?
2020.
Okay, because we're in 2022 as we record.
Sorry,
this.
I forgot it was 2022 now. Yeah. It's New Year's Day, people, when we're recording this, for context. I'm not just like a week in and forgetting what year it is. But you know what I mean? Like, there is something about, you can kind of adjust to anything.
Yes.
But kind of experiencing the thing that was missing, it's hard to let it go again.
Yep.
And then the other way that this kind of like real deep need for connection to living things arises in this world is this need to have an animal. Like, everyone, this is where the electric sheep of it all comes in. So it's a real status symbol to have like a pet animal, and it can be any animal. Like, it could be a sheep, it can be a goat, it could be a bird, you know, it's any living thing. And it's linked in with the religion they have, Mercerism, which elevates living things and caring for nature and all those things kind of above all else. Another quote from the book that Rick Deckard thinks is, so he can't afford a real animal, so he has an electric sheep. He knows it's electric.
Yeah.
His neighbors don't.
Yeah.
You know, it's so, he still has like the status of having a sheep, but he knows it's electric. And the quote he says about it is, he thought too about his need for a real animal. Within him, an actual hatred once more manifested itself towards his electric sheep, which he had to tend, had to care about as if it lived. The tyranny of an object, he thought, it doesn't know I exist. Like the androids, it has no ability to appreciate the existence of another.
Yeah.
And like, to me, that really reflects this need to be understood, to be seen, to be acknowledged, just for the sheer act of existing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not about like compliments or even being acknowledged for what you do, but just being like, I am a human seeing another human, or I'm a living creature seeing another living creature.
It's to affirm that you are in fact a living creature.
Yeah, it's just, it's that really foundational acknowledgement that this, like, this whole sort of topic of empathy and connection really delves into in a world that has been broken by war and that a lot of people have left. You know, what do we do? And there's so much isolation in this world. what do we do to connect?
Yeah.
Like another thing I haven't really written any notes about it is like there's the TV is like always on, like there's 24/7 these same sort of personalities on TV, and that's their whole job. And it's honestly company, I think, the way it's portrayed in the book sometimes is like you just have it on and there's a person talking to you.
Yeah.
Even though it's across the TV or across the radio or that's whatever it is.
That's a thing that I think that's a common, it wouldn't surprise me if he's commenting on the fact, even as back then in 1968, you probably hear friends saying this as you grow up, you probably hear family members say this, like, or when you go to someone's house, the TV's just on.
Yeah. Like, I used to do it. I used to just want the noise on in the background. On. Yeah.
Like the only time it would get turned off is if literally no one was in the house. If one person was in the house, no one would think, oh, there's no one in the room, so I'll turn off the TV in the front. No, it just stayed on.
I don't do it now because we don't, you know.
No, I don't do it now. What? Because we don't watch live television.
No, because we don't watch live television. We only have streaming. So it would be weird to go out of my way to put on streaming. But when I lived at home and I did have live television, I would like do my assignments and stuff with the TV on in the background because too much silence would actually freak me out. You know, I'd be like, I need to have something going. Yeah. So I completely understand that urge, you know. I suppose the last thing is also, what does it say about like the earth and destruction?
Yeah.
Because to me, it really seems like the deep reverence for animals and this religion of mercerism is a response to like destruction and war. Like we're going to give this huge reverence to life and nature and what the earth has produced because it's kind of not there anymore. Like radiation is bad.
Yeah.
It's really bad. Like it's quite easy to say like fuck it about the world when people were like in the book are literally incentivized to leave if they can. Like they're like, well, if you go to Mars, we will give you a free like robot android servant.
Yeah.
There's lots of reasons for you to go. And obviously all the radiation is the stick that drives you as well. Yeah. But it does throw up this like number of ethical dilemmas to think about, like about people themselves, about the androids, like the androids on Mars are trying to escape to Earth because life as an android is so awful, about what needs to be done to maintain the integrity of human genetics. That's why they are colonizing, because the radiation is
destroying
people's genes. Like that's what radiation does, it damages DNA. Like it does raise these questions, like what do you do? There is no kind of perfect answer. It's just interesting to see how that plays out. I'm interested in the world that this book creates. Do you know what I mean? And like, I know that it is, I don't know in what ways the movie is different, but I know it is different.
Yes.
Like even just the fact that it's called Blade Runner,
which
is not mentioned in, that's not a phrase that occurs in the book. I'm pretty sure I read somewhere in an interview, it was just something someone thought of like, and Ridley Scott was like, that sounds cool, let's go with it. Or you know, something like that. It was like something, that kind of a thing. It wasn't based out of the text itself.
No.
Which I'm not sure if this comes out of the movie or not, and you can certainly tell me if it is. But I saw a lot of questions online when I was doing my research on this, like, oh, is Rick Deckard an android after all? Yeah,
I used to hear that like 10 years before I even saw the movie. Like, I've been hearing that conversation since I was, like tiny.
I
didn't see the movie until, like,
that's why I'm interested in seeing the movie, because I have an opinion based on the book, and I would say no, he isn't. I can see why you could make the argument, but I think that, to me, like, I suppose that's the question, isn't it? Like, I get the vibe that he isn't, but that also raises the question of, like, well, isn't that exactly what Philip K. Dick is trying to say, you know? Like, who is human and who is android? And actually, what does differentiate the two?
Sometimes, though, you just gotta... People like to come up with mad... Not mad theories, but outlandish... Not even conspiracies, but outlandish sort of ideas that take, in their mind, the work to a whole new level and place.
So I don't even think it's actually that outlandish, because there is a point in the book where he is like, am I an android? Like, he questions himself, but he does the test.
Yeah.
And he... So this is, I suppose, the question. Big spoiler here. This is the question. He gets the empathy test done to him, and he passes it as a human. But I suppose the question is then, has he passed it because he's a human, or has he passed it because he's so advanced? Now, I would say he, like, has a wife and a life, and he's not one of these new Nexus Sixes if he's been around a long time. So probably not.
Yeah.
But I can see why the question arises. I suppose I wondered, is that maybe more of an element of the movie, and that's why people think
Yeah, I've heard that.
Okay.
Literally for, I can't even remember how long at this point, but decades, it feels like. Because I know I've heard that theory for years before I'd ever seen the film. All I heard was, is Deckard a replicant? Yeah. I'd heard that question asked in conversations, in random film magazines. I'd know I'd seen that before I'd ever seen the movie.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it, and it just hadn't occurred to me when I was reading the book. So that's why I'm interested in seeing the movie, to kind of compare the two, and also because I'm a big sci-fi nerd. So this is the thing. I like books and movies, etc., but especially books that are easily consumed.
Yep.
Like, they go down real smooth.
Yeah.
But there is a level of depth to it that you can chew upon. Do you know what I mean? That is my favourite type of thing. Because obviously, like I say, there's a lot of things that are very intellectual and you do have a lot to discuss, but it is more work to do it.
Yeah.
And I'm not averse to that. It's like, you know, we talk about challenging albums and stuff, and you do have to put some work into some albums. And yes, the payoff can be worth it in the end. But there is something I enjoy about something that goes down real smooth and sticks with you. And
like a delicious mousse.
Yeah, and doesn't, like, there's some stuff that goes down real easy, and after like a day you're like, I'm done with this now, I'm sick of this. I think this does fall in that nice middle ground.
Okay.
Which I enjoy. And yeah, it's high recommend to all. I know for this year coming, I do want to read more. This wasn't the only Philip K. Dick book I read this 2021, this year just gone. But I do want to read even more. Because I'm going to continue this sci-fi kick for a while, I think. Because it's just a really enjoyable little romp out of, I suppose, other things I could be consuming. But yeah. That's it for me. Any thoughts before we wrap this boy up?
Watch Blade Runner is my thought.
Heads up, not available on streaming. You will just have to rent it.
Yeah, just in case.
But you can rent it, so I may just do that.
Shall I say what I'm going to do?
Yes, you should absolutely say what you're going to do
Sorry,
next.
My brain just went a bit funny there. I don't know why. Yeah, so this episode, obviously, you had a very interesting sort of... It's like a very interesting book report. Lots of interesting themes. You know, it's been a bit more of a serious episode. You know, the last two have been quite, you know, we've talked about more serious, a bit more serious. The next episode we'll be doing is tangentially related to this one, only in the fact that Harrison Ford
is linked to both. Yeah.
You see, the next episode we will be doing one of my personal favourite. It's an ITV classic. For those of you who don't know, that is a film that will just be on ITV at least once every 6 months to a year for about a decade. We will be doing Harrison Ford as one of the great fictional presidents in Air Force One.
Yay! I'm excited.
You should be.
Okay.
Get off my podcast.
Wow.
Anyway, that makes sense in context.
Happy New Year. Thank you for listening.
Thanks very much.
See you next time. Bye.
Goodbye. You were listening to the Darling Why podcast, presented by Louis Tangarides and Kate Stewart. If you liked what you heard, please feel free to give us a follow at Darling Why Podcast on Instagram. Feel free to rate and subscribe on whatever podcast feed you're listening to. This podcast is produced, edited, and put together entirely by Louis Tangarides and Kate Stewart. Thanks for listening. See you next time.